Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, an in-depth analysis of the growing crisis with the U.S. and North Korea. And first, how one man infiltrated the Nazi cells and foiled their plots to sow chaos in Los Angeles. Stephen Ross is with us now. He is a professor of history at the University of Southern California. His latest book is Hitler in Los Angeles. So welcome back to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you, Stephen Ross.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
I was reading your book, and you opened with a quote from Hitler in the prologue about how to take power in the USA. And he essentially said it was to undermine the people's morale and faith in the government and sow confusion. Now, it seems like that's what was the effort at the time that you've been researching Hitler in Los Angeles. But it also seems like there's some parallels today, don't you think?
Yeah, well, the only difference is the end part of that quote that you didn't read was that this was to sow dissension in preparation for taking over the government. We now have people sowing hate on the streets of the United States, not for the purpose of taking over the government, but of sort of, in a sense, reasserting white superiority at a time when they know they are on the losing end of history.
Right, but the idea of sowing confusion in the government is something that other governments overseas do try to do, sowing confusion in this way.
Right, the only problem is right now our own government is sowing confusion amongst its people. It doesn't need a foreign government to come in and do that for them.
Right. So why was Joseph Goebbels focused on Los Angeles?
Well, there are two answers to that. One is why Goebbels was focused on Los Angeles, and the second one is why were the Nazis in general focused on Los Angeles? And for Goebbels, it was because he and Hitler both loved movies. They both watched them regularly. They loved Hollywood films in general, and particularly Walt Disney films. And they felt that had it not been for the propaganda machine coming out of Hollywood and British cinema during World War I, that Germany could have swayed a lot more of world opinion to its side. And when Hitler came into power in 1933, he immediately appointed Goebbels as his Reich Minister of Enlightenment and Propaganda, an odd combination. And Goebbels decided that they were going to make sure that Hollywood would not do this again. And so he sent to Los Angeles in June 1933 German consul George Gisling with one mission, and that is to prevent the studios from making any film that attacked, denigrated, mocked Hitler or Nazi Germany. And the power he had was something called Article 15 of a German import law from a few years before that said that the German government had the power to ban any film or even nation if its films denigrated in any way the Nazis, the German government and people. And so Hollywood moguls went along thinking two things. One, that, well, Hitler isn't going to really be in power that long. You know, he rose there, you know, with his anti-Semitism, but he's going to calm down, and either he'll calm down or be out of power. And the other feeling was, in the meantime, we have to stay in the German market, which is our second most profitable market in Europe, next to Great Britain. And so Goebbels got his man on the job, and he did the job. And that was all. He was also aided because a year later, Hollywood passed the production code that also contained a clause saying you can't mock or attack a foreign government. And so we had no, even though many studios wanted to produce anti-Nazi movies starting in 1933, none of them could because they wouldn't get a seal of approval from the production code administration. And so we didn't get our first anti-Nazi movie until April 1939. It's a long time. And Goebbels' arm reached for a long time across the ocean and into Hollywood.
Fascinating. You know, simultaneously, you noted that in Los Angeles and Southern California in general, there was a historic anti-Semitism. So it was already a bit of a hotbed. Would you say there was a sense of like already a community that Goebbels and Hitler could reach out to?
Oh, yes. This was a Southern California, particularly south of Los Angeles, but Los Angeles as well, was a hotbed of reactionary activity. Long Beach was a major center for Ku Klux Klan, as was Orange County. By the 1920s, polite society in Los Angeles was progressively excluding Jews from various clubs and even limiting their participation in the Chamber of Commerce. And you had a anywhere from a polite to open anti-Semitism in L.A. and Southern California. The other thing that the German government understood is that even though New York was the kind of center of Jewish America, it was also overseen by Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia, who is half Jewish. And LaGuardia was a strong anti-Nazi, and he made sure that the ports of New York were closely guarded against any kind of Nazi efforts to smuggle in people, propaganda, money, orders. And so they started shipping everything to Los Angeles. And in my book, I talk about the spy ring that was started by Leon Lewis, and his spies managed to become right-hand men to the Nazi leaders, and they went down to the docks and saw them exchanging money, orders, packages with the either the ship captain or the Gestapo officer on the ship. And so L.A. became spy central for Germany, sending through its own sort of espionage and sabotage.
Well, let's back up a little, because I think that this is the main point of the book, Hitler in Los Angeles, which is that Leon Lewis organized these spies to find out what these Nazi groups were doing so that he could try to circumvent their efforts. So how big were these cells, for lack of a better term, of these Nazi groups?
Probably at their peak, several hundred. But you need to remember that a number of these people were devoted Nazis who were drilling with weaponry on a regular basis, practicing armed combat, and particularly practicing urban armed combat. And the Nazis had announced that they were going to, one day, the communists were going to rise up against the American government, and on that day, the Nazis would be the group that would lead Americans to, you know, kill the communists and stop the threat to American democracy. At least that's what they said to everyone. So, you know, you had a hardcore that were committed to doing whatever it took to basically, in America, preach anti-Semitism and to prepare for the day that Hitler would invade the United States.
And Leon Lewis, let's talk about him as a leader. At the time, you noted that people were protesting and boycotting, but he thought that these were not really all that useful, so he wanted to do something more practical. Tell us more about Leon Lewis.
Well, Leon Lewis was born in the 1880s in Wisconsin and wound up going to university and then law school at University of Chicago. And when he graduated in 1913, he became one of the three founding members of the Anti-Defamation League in Chicago. And he served as their first executive secretary until he left to serve in World War I. And when he came back from service, he told the other executives there that they needed to start monitoring anti-Semitism abroad. And so he took on a second hat as the executive secretary of the international division of the ADL. And he moved to L.A. in 1930-31 and opened his own law practice here. And that's what he expected to do for the rest of his life. But when Nazis held their first open meeting in Los Angeles at the end of July 1933 and announced that, you know, their intention was to rid the country of communists and Jews, who they thought were one and the same, Lewis said, that's enough talk. We now need to swing into action. And so he went to his local post of the Disabled American Veterans, and he began by recruiting four World War I veterans and their wives, all of whom agreed to go undercover and join every Nazi and fascist group in Los Angeles and try to rise to positions of power, and then send back daily reports on what they discovered. And once they did, within a few weeks, they sent him back reports about an attempt to seize armories in San Francisco, L.A., and San Diego by Nazi plot to seize the armories, and on a specific day, there would be an uprising. Nazi troops, both from boats and from the Friends of New Germany, would storm the armories, take over the arms. They would ask any soldier who wanted to join them to do so, and anyone who refused, they would shoot on the spot. When Leon Lewis heard this, he went immediately to the chief of police in Los Angeles, James Davis, and he started telling him about this, and Davis stopped him and said, you know, you got it all wrong. Hitler's got it right. He's only doing what he needs to do to fix the German economy because the Jews have proven such a problem in Germany. And in fact, the real problem in Los Angeles isn't with the Nazis, it's with all those communists in Boyle Heights, which was the Jewish neighborhood of L.A. at the time. And as far as the captain was concerned, he let Leon Lewis know that every communist was a Jew and every Jew was a communist. And when he went to the sheriff's department, he was also rebuffed. And when he went to the FBI, he was told there's nothing we can do unless we give orders from Washington, D.C. And so it was at that point that Leon Lewis realized that American government officials were so obsessed with finding communists that they didn't give a damn about Nazis and fascists, and that he never intended to be a spy master, but he had to do it because no one else was paying attention. And he kept doing it until the end of World War II.
Obviously, these are dangerous missions, and they had to be really well thought out. And the ways in which he thought out how each of these spies could get admitted into the groups, and then there were times when they were questioned, their loyalty was questioned. There was always the risk, of course, of getting co-opted. So these are dangerous missions. Lewis himself was under constant threat of retaliation, right?
Right.
Now, at what point did the Nazi groups know about Leon Lewis, and how much did they know about him?
Well, I think they knew within 3 months that Leon Lewis was running some kind of undercover operation, and they knew it for sure within the first year. They just didn't know who any of his spies were, and they never did, and they dubbed him the most dangerous Jew in Los Angeles. And it's interesting that they tried to kidnap his children at one point, but they never tried to assassinate Leon Lewis.
So it was dangerous for him. And there were times when they challenged the loyalty of some of the spies, like Schmidt, for example.
Right. Well, let's put it this way. Over the course of his spying operation, from 1933 until 1943, three of his spies died under highly suspicious circumstances. And I'm convinced two of them were either killed or Nazi sympathizers were complicit in the death of two of the three spies.
So they were discovered at some point, or at least
suspected. Well, they were, mainly because his first four spies, with the exception, his first four spies were three Christians and one Jew. And in fact, almost all his spies were Christians. And he had the three Christian spies testify at a trial. And once they did that, they were both known to the German community and under danger. And John Schmidt, the first of the spies who was German-born, at the trial they came over to him and kept telling him that he was a dead man. He was a dead man. And that they were going to kill him for betraying his country. So these were very courageous people because they knew that the Nazis would at some point carry out their threat.
You know, some of the plans, like you talked about the overthrow of the U.S. government via uprisings to spark violence, did they have a comprehensive plan for this?
Not really. Yes and no. They had the outlines and blueprints, because in my book I talk about various national leaders forging a kind of united front of fascists and Nazis in America in major cities around the country. And while they never had a single line of communication saying, we're going to do this and this on the same day, they were all preparing for the day in which one of them would actually start a series of pogroms, and then that would inspire the others to take up arms and just start massacring Jews in every major city. And they talked about that. They talked about turning the major cities of America into a Jewish bloodbath. But no one ever coordinated a national response. They did have local plots, though. And in the case of L.A., those plots never happened because Leon Lewis's spies were able to foil them time and time again.
And were they generally plots like the one that he foiled related to the Bay Area?
They were much more sinister. There were two plots to... They knew that Hollywood and Los Angeles were synonymous. And if you wanted to get world's attention, if you had killing of Jews in Portland, no one was going to care. If you had the killing of Jews in New Jersey, no one was going to care. And even in New York, which the Nazis referred to as Jew York, no one was going to care. But if you murdered Hollywood moguls and movie stars, the whole world would pay attention. And so there were two plots in two successive years, one of which they were going to hang 20 Jews, Hollywood figures as well as political figures, and then they would shoot their bodies, as they put it, full of lead after they were dangling on the rope. And they believed that this would send a worldwide message and lead to pogroms. But that got foiled by one of Lewis's ace spies, Chuck Slocum, who persuaded the plotters that Leon Lewis had an agent inside and that if they went ahead and did this, they would be caught and tried for murder. And so they decided to postpone it until they could figure out who the spy was, which they never did. And in a second instance that was even more shocking, it was a British fascist, Leopold McLaughlin, who had been at one point the world's jiu-jitsu champion and had taught jiu-jitsu and arm-to-arm combat to Scotland Yard in the Sûreté, came to Los Angeles in the late in 1937 and organized a plot to kill 24 Hollywood figures. And in this case, it was going to be all producers and movie stars, and two movie stars who were Christian but too sympathetic to the Jews, Charlie Chaplin and James Cagney. And they were convinced that if you hung 24, rather they were going to blow up the homes of these 24 people on the same night, that you bet they were right. That would have gotten the whole world to pay attention, and they believed it would have emboldened everyone in America, every anti-Semite, to take action against the Jewish problem. And again, that was foiled by Leon Lewis's ace spy, Chuck Slocum.
Now, simultaneously, some of the people in these Nazi groups were infiltrating Hollywood companies, right?
Right. I mean, that's one of the interesting discoveries I made, is that the undercover agents found that, you know, the studio heads were paying attention to what we call above-the-line personnel. That is, the names that appear at the beginning of a movie, when you go in and you see the credits roll. So it'll be the movie stars, the writer, the director, the producers. And then at the very end of the movie, when they have all the craftsmen and the workers from the film, the general workers, that's referred to as below the line. Well, the studio chiefs were not paying attention to the below the line, and Leon Lewis's spies discovered that many of the studio foremen who did the hiring and firing were members, either pro-Nazi or members of their American equivalent, the Silver Shirts, and that they were firing every Jewish craft worker in the studios. In some places, like Paramount, had reached almost 100%, quote, Aryan employees and below the line. And even Louis B. Mayer, the sort of biggest Jew of them all, his studio, MGM, had been penetrated by the Silver Shirts, including the head of the L.A. Silver Shirts, and he had no idea.
So Leon Lewis then was able to go to some of the big Hollywood executives and moguls and finally get them to understand what was happening, right?
Right, more than get them to understand it, he had a secret meeting at Hillcrest Country Club, which had been founded by Jews after they discovered they were excluded from every country club in L.A. because they were Jews. So they opened their own club and ironically struck oil within a short amount of time. But they came, 40 of the major Hollywood leaders, mostly studio chiefs and the number two and three people, and a few other producers, directors, had a secret meeting where Leon Lewis told them everything that was going on, and in fact how Nazis in silver shirts were in their studios and how they were in danger. And by the end of the evening, the moguls had agreed, even though they were publicly doing business with Germany, they hated having to do so. And when they found out Nazis were in their studio, they went crazy, and they underwrote Lewis's entire operation for the rest of the for the duration of his spy operation.
Some of the other things I thought were really notable, not so much necessarily in telling of the story, but in the context of what was going on at the time. You mentioned in the book that because they were cutting pensions for veterans, that it actually fueled the sort of Nazi movement. How did that all work?
Well, what the Nazis did, when the Nazis opened up their first meeting in Los Angeles in July 1933, their aim was to follow the same strategy that Hitler had done in the 1920s when he recruited his brown shirts. And that is, he recruited them amongst military veterans who were really upset because the German government had cut their benefits. And they felt like, here we were patriots, we went to war, and now that we've come back, no one cares about us. We've been thrown on the, you know, the trash heap of history. And many of them were very angry, and they were looking for answers and looking for scapegoats, and Hitler came along and said, I can save you. I can make Germany great again. You know, I can answer all your problems, and only I can do this. And the first thing we're going to do is, you know, get rid of the Jews from power. They've really screwed our country over. And so he had sent, in March, a military veteran from Germany, Captain Robert Pape, to organize, you know, essentially an American brown shirt army. And that's why they were so interested in John Schmidt and the first four of Leon Lewis's spies, because they were hoping, if these people would be sympathetic to them, they would recruit former American veterans who in turn could both recruit and teach other Americans, drill them in military tactics, and they could raise an army that would be ready to support Hitler's forces in America at any moment.
Now, do you know if the groups at the time, the Nazi groups at the time, had any connection to what we currently still see with the white supremacy groups or the KKK or any of those? Were they interconnected?
Yes, they were, actually. They were independent by and large, but by the mid-30s, they created in Los Angeles a United Fascist Front that had representatives from each of these organizations talking about common strategies and common plotting and raising money amongst a common array of people who they thought would be sympathetic and would give money to all of them, in particular if they could show how powerful the fascist movement was. And the other thing is, you had cross-membership. People in the Klan also belonged to groups like the American Rangers. You had some members of the Friends of New Germany that later became the German-American Bund, who belonged to the Silver Shirts. So you had cross-pollination of fascist groups in the city and across the country.
So toward the end, how many Nazis from these groups ended up in jail as a result of Lewis's spy network?
Well, there were quite a few arrested and detained right after Pearl Harbor, certainly in the 90s, low hundreds. Many others put under surveillance. A number of them remained in jail for weeks or a few months. But in terms of long-term prison sentences, only two remained in prison, and that is Hermann Schwinn, who was the head of the Bund in Los Angeles and also known as the Gauleiter for the Western District, meaning he was the head Nazi for all Bund chapters in the Western United States, and his number one man, Hans Deibel, they were put in jail on December 8th, and Deibel was not released until around 1946, and Hermann Schwinn was not released until around 1947, and he was then sent to Argentina.
So were these related to the sedition trial?
Yes, they were. These many of the Nazis and fascists were put on trial multiple times, and finally the 1944 trial was called the Great Sedition Trial, because in a number of cases they had urged young Americans of draft age not to enter the draft if we were drafted, and in fact to openly oppose it if we went into war. And they were doing it even after Pearl Harbor, and so a number of them were arrested for sedition, put on trial, and eventually the charges were thrown out, mainly because the judge died, and then they discovered the case wasn't strong enough, and by that time, it was the beginnings of the Cold War, and nobody cared about Nazis. They were all focusing on Reds.
So your book comes out as we've been seeing sort of a rise in white supremacism, these emboldened marches, and evidence of at least one other country seeming to try to affect American democratic processes. I wonder two things. One is, what can we learn from history that we can bring forward today?
Well, I would say the big lesson of the book is that when hate groups move from the margins to the mainstream, and when government authorities seem either complacent or complicit, it's up to every American to stand up and basically stand up against hate. And whether it's gestures large or small, you know, you hear somebody making hate speech, stop them. Say something. There's a demonstration against these groups, go. Be there. Be peaceful. But make sure that they know this is not okay, that this is not normal, that in fact, you know, hate festers if no one speaks up.
You know, one of the other points that was early on in the book had to do with when people were trying to organize in opposition to the Nazi groups, they couldn't come to any agreement about what needed to be done. And so groups, they splintered and were therefore ineffective.
Yes, and that's why one of the things I learned, and I sort of wrote in the prologue that I had also believed, you know, this idea that Jews didn't, in America, didn't do enough to stop Hitler, and that they were passive in the wake of Nazism, and that's entirely wrong. Jews, as you point out, had a divided strategy, and the division was basically, do we get in Hitler's face through an international boycott of German goods and just keep making it tighter and tighter and hurt the German economy, or do we work behind the scenes and try to get German religious leaders to pressure Hitler? Because that group that worked wanted to work behind the scenes said, if you get in Hitler's face, he's going to double down and make it worse for the Jews. And the aggressive group said, well, nothing's going to happen if we take your path. And so they could never quite agree. And it was really only after Kristallnacht in November 1938 that they began cooperating more. What I also realized is that, once again, to blame Jewish groups in America for being complacent, which is not true, but even to say, well, you never even came together until it was too late, seems to me is blaming the victim sort of analogy, when really the question to ask is, why did the American government remain so complacent, oblivious, and in many cases supportive of Nazis and fascists? And what I saw is tremendous in Los Angeles, tremendous amount of anti-Semitism within government officials, including the head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, who was so obsessed with tracking down Reds that he didn't order, despite his own local agents saying, you got to put Hermann Schwinn, the number two Nazi in America, under surveillance. Hoover didn't order it until November, the middle of November 1941, you know, less than a month away from Pearl Harbor. So if there's any blame, it should be upon the head of American government and not upon the head of American Jews.
And it seemed like while there was not support for Lewis and his efforts initially, he did eventually find support in the administration. Isn't that right?
Well, not in the administration per se, but there were people who would listen to the... They started, he and his associate, Spymaster Joe Roos, started putting out a news research letter in 1939. And that was sent to a lot of government officials, and they would take a lot of their spy material and turn it into articles without revealing any information that people could use to identify their spies. But the other thing they were doing, particularly after the beginning of World War II, is they were sending lists. They were compiling lists of all suspicious Nazis, Italian fascists, and to a lesser extent, even Japanese fascists. And they were mailing those lists on a regular basis to Army intelligence, Naval intelligence, and the FBI. And so, you know, the interesting question I had to ask myself is, you know, after Pearl Harbor, the FBI in Los Angeles was widely praised for rounding up the Nazis and fascists so quickly. And I said to myself, how's that possible if they didn't even have them under surveillance? And the answer is they used the lists that Leon Lewis and Joe Roos had sent them. And I found those lists in the National Archives. And both the Army, the Navy, and the FBI just retyped those lists with the same information Lewis had given them. And in fact, Joe Roos had divided them into three categories: most dangerous, keep under surveillance, and watch out for. And the Attorney General sent the list to Los Angeles FBI, and instead of calling them that, he called it Group A, B, and C, and said go after Group A first. And they were all people from Lewis and Roos's list. So it was these two Jews running an undercover spy ring that in a sense saved the city from disaster and helped the FBI round up the suspects after Pearl Harbor.
So the difference that one or two people can really make in this.
That's right, and that's what I mean. And the interesting thing is Leon Lewis, Joe Roos, and their spies, they never fired a weapon. They used the most powerful weapon of all, their brain. And they did it in a nonviolent, non-confrontational way. And they essentially defeated their enemy without much help from the government.
And what remains of the groups today?
Which groups? The hate groups?
Yeah.
Well, in America, they've been resurgent since the election because we have a president who doesn't condemn them, who's ambivalent, who can say there are good people on both sides. Well, I have to tell you, there are no good people on the side of hate and fascism and anti-democracy. There are no good people.
Well, Stephen Ross, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for sharing your research with us.
Well, thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
Stephen Ross is a professor of history at the University of Southern California. His latest book is Hitler in Los Angeles. When we come back, an in-depth analysis of the growing crisis with the U.S. and North Korea. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How can we make sense of the North Korea situation? Are there really reasons to be alarmed? We're joined by two experts. Stephen Haggard is professor of Korea-Pacific Studies and Political Science at the University of California, San Diego, and director of the Korea-Pacific Program. His latest book is Hard Target: Sanctions, Inducement, and the Case of North Korea. Charles Armstrong also joins us. He is a professor of Korean studies at Columbia University, and he is the author of The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, and The Koreas. So welcome both of you to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you back with us here. I thought we would start with a piece that was in the ABC News, where they suggested that the problems facing the United States and North Korea are really becoming intractable. So before we go into some deep history, which I'd like to do next, I wanted to assess if that statement was just attention-grabbing, or is the problem now that serious? Charles Armstrong, what do you think?
I don't know if the problems are intractable, but I think we are at a very significant historical inflection point. The position of the U.S. in Asia is, I would argue, inevitably in decline, and it seems to have accelerated during this administration. And China is full of confidence, just coming off the Chinese Communist Party Congress, and it's going to play an even larger role in the region. So there certainly are problems, and there will continue to be problems going forward, some of them quite serious. But I don't think the U.S. position there is really so dire, but we have to recognize the kinds of shifts of power that are going on right now.
Stephen Haggard.
I think that most people who watch North Korea have come to the conclusion that the likelihood that the North Koreans will denuclearize is probably pretty low. It's obviously going to be more difficult to negotiate denuclearization with a country that's already broken out and has a quite substantial capacity. Particularly when we think of the investments that the regime has made in the program, and both on the missile and the nuclear front. So I wouldn't say that the problem is intractable, but I certainly think that the path out is probably pretty narrow.
So let's go into some deep history. What is it we need to understand first about North Korea itself to understand the current situation really? Charles Armstrong, what would you say?
I think we have to first understand that the regime has shown remarkable resilience and survivability, whatever we may think of it. I think there's been a lot of wishful thinking for years, even decades, that the regime is fragile and it's going to go away. I don't think we can count on that anytime soon. So we have to accept that North Korea is with us probably for a while, and others may disagree with that, but that's my reading of it. Second, it's very clear, and Kim Jong-un has said it himself numerous times, that North Korea does not see nuclear weapons as a bargaining chip, but as essential to their survival and even their national identity. And as Steph says, that makes the solution to this problem going forward very difficult. The third thing we have to understand is the real serious consequences of any military action, which are now potentially more dangerous than ever before, precisely because North Korea has nuclear weapons and because the vulnerability of Seoul and other American interests in the regions to a North Korean retaliation. So with that in mind, I think although the problem seems extremely difficult to solve, and is difficult to solve, we have to consider how we might reach a peaceful solution to this, and soon, before the situation really does spin out of control.
Stephen Haggard, deep history. I know you've done quite a bit on this.
Oh, well, and Charles, of course, is one of the preeminent historians on North Korea himself. But I guess I would say, first, just endorse what Charles has said, but maybe put it in a somewhat different way. I think we have had a belief that authoritarian regimes more generally are fragile. And one of the things we're seeing is that certain types of authoritarian regimes are surprisingly resilient. And they're resilient not simply because they're able to withstand shocks or impose costs on their populations and repress. They're also resilient because they manage to come up with legitimating formula that they can advance through the propaganda machinery and through control of media. And so I think it's very important to see North Korea as at least potentially a resilient authoritarian country. But the second point I think that's important for the more narrow question of the nuclear conjuncture where we are now is that the North Korean leadership believes in what it has called the Byung-jin line, which means that Kim Jong-un believes he can simultaneously pursue economic reconstruction, as he calls it, economic development, and simultaneously maintain his nuclear weapons. And I think liberals, myself included, frankly, in the past, have thought that if the regime put greater emphasis on economic questions, that it would perforce have to open and start to moderate its nuclear behavior. And that may still prove to be correct, but it doesn't seem to be what Kim Jong-un himself believes.
Now, you...
I'd like to add one more thing, if
yes,
I could,
please.
About the historical question, and that is something Americans often forget, how deeply intertwined we have been with North Korean history. From the very beginning, from the decision to divide the country along with the Soviets, from the Korean War, in which, of course, 35,000 Americans died, and as a source of existential threat to North Korea for 65 years. So this is nothing new. North Korea sees the U.S. as a threat to its existence, and there have been a few moments in which we could break away from that, but we have to be, I think, very careful of the kinds of statements U.S. officials make that play into North Korea's perception, which is wrapped up in their national identity of the United States as a hostile and imminent threat to their existence.
Well, that was going to be where I went next, which was about the relationship with the United States, but also the regional players. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the geopolitics and the relationships over history with the players in that region and abroad. So, Charles Armstrong, would you start?
Geopolitics, as I said at the outset, are shifting, and in a very interesting way. But there have been the two most important players since the Korean War, in the United States and China. And however, what we shouldn't do is underestimate the importance of Korean agency, and particularly North Korean. Steph may say more about the broader geopolitics, but I would like to say that North Korea itself has been remarkably adept, and that's part of their resilience and survivability, at dealing with much more powerful countries than themselves and playing them off against each other. That's how they got through the Cold War, playing off China and Russia, and they continue to play the U.S. and attempt to play U.S. against China, in sometimes not a very deft, but in sometimes very successful ways. So when we talk about the geopolitics of the region, we shouldn't only think about the great powers, but the ways in which both Koreas have tried to work with and against the great powers to shift the odds in their favor.
Stephen Haggard, what would you say?
The six-party talks were the vehicle through which this issue was addressed up until 2008 when the talks collapsed. And so that roster of countries provides you a sort of dramatis personae of Northeast Asia. Russia and Japan have lesser roles in the drama, though recently it's certainly possible that as Putin is pressed on what they call the Western Front, he may seek to play a more active role in North Korea and maybe even be a spoiler. But I think that the four parties that are really central here are China, the United States, and the two Koreas. And there still is a legacy of a sort of Cold War divide that surfaces periodically on this. So China has been very clear that their position on denuclearization is firm. That is, they think that the Korean Peninsula should be denuclearized, and that means that North Korea should be denuclearized because South Korea doesn't have nuclear weapons. So at the grand level of declaratory policy, China is very clear that its objectives are actually parallel to those of the United States. The differences are really tactical, that China is very concerned that North Korea not be pushed into a corner. And even though North Korea's trade with China has expanded dramatically and its leverage, therefore, Beijing's leverage over Pyongyang has expanded, China's reluctant to use that leverage fully because it doesn't want to upset the stability, which has actually characterized the peninsula in a strange way, even though it's a sort of Cold War stability. So I think the big issues on the president's trip coming up are going to be if the United States and China can agree on a kind of common strategy that combines an adequate pressure to get North Korea back to the table without driving wedges between China and the United States, to which Charles alluded, which basically plays to North Korea's advantage.
So one of the things that you mentioned earlier on was about the existential threat that North Korea feels about the United States. And there were some comments about North Korea watching the other U.S.-led interventions, particularly in the Middle East, as sort of evidence that they have this existential threat. Would you say that this is a real issue today?
I think that has been a lesson for North Korea and for Kim Jong-un in particular, seeing what happened to Saddam Hussein in Iraq when they were accused of having weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons, and they did not. They were invaded, and Saddam Hussein was deposed and executed. And even more important was the lesson of Libya, which offered to give up its nuclear weapons and then was promptly invaded, not directly by the U.S., but by Western powers, destabilized, and Gaddafi was eliminated. So the lesson drawn from that appears to be that the best way for Kim Jong-un to ensure the survival of his regime is to have a credible nuclear deterrent. Unfortunately, that's exactly what the U.S. and other members of the international community, including China, do not want North Korea to have. And so that's the dilemma and the profound contradiction that we find ourselves in right now. I wanted to add one more thing to complement what Steph just said. China and the U.S. are approaching North Korea with common ultimate goals, they say, but with different approaches. And I think both are somewhat frustrated in the other. The U.S. wants China to put more pressure on North Korea through economic sanctions and through enforcing them more effectively. But China has also said repeatedly they want the U.S. and North Korea to start a dialogue with one another, and that only through some sort of diplomatic negotiation can this really be resolved. So I agree that strategically they have common goals, but tactically they are rather far apart right now. That is, U.S. and China vis-a-vis North Korea.
You know, Charles Armstrong, you had written back in 2016 about diplomacy being a solution, but that the previous administration really didn't use diplomacy at all, just sort of stood by. Why don't you tell us what happened there? And then that should walk us into the current administration, which seems to be doing really the profound opposite of diplomacy.
Well, I think there were some overtures toward diplomacy on the part of the Obama administration, including in particular an agreement they made with North Korea in 2012 at the end of February, which unfortunately was scuttled a couple of weeks later when North Korea fired a missile or made a missile test. But predominantly, the Obama administration was characterized by a policy which some of its members called strategic patience, which seemed to me a policy of really not doing very much and waiting somehow for things to change. And what happened was the North Korean threat continued to grow during that time. And so, in a sense, the Trump administration has taken the opposite approach, perhaps you can call it strategic impatience, although I don't know how much strategy there really is here, to really push North Korea as hard as possible, both on the economic sanctions front and on the front of military threats. It's not clear that is going to be successful either. What's missing in both regards is a serious, it seems to me, attempt at offering some sort of a diplomatic solution, which certainly will be very difficult, but is also essential to avoid an escalation of conflict.
Stephen Haggard?
I think one of the problems that all the parties are facing, and this is no less true of China than of the United States, is that North Korea's interest in negotiating is now increasingly in question. Recall that your question had to do in part with how North Korea's capabilities have affected this drama. And one of the big differences between Iran and North Korea was that Iran didn't have an existing capability that would have to give up. It was giving up some technology, particularly its centrifuge program, that might have, at some distant point, yielded a weapon. North Korea now has a weapon. It seems to feel free, it seems to feel safe in the protection that deterrent provides. And as a result of that, it's going to be more complicated to get to a negotiated agreement. I think that some kind of set of security assurances that would have to involve China to assure that the North Koreans don't suffer a Libyan or Iraqi outcome would probably be a piece of that. But it's going to take some really deft diplomacy to convince the North Koreans that they're going to be as secure giving up their nuclear program, even if gradually over an extended period of time, and keeping it. And one of the reasons I think that there's been so much focus on sanctions, which has been the subject of my recent work, is because the only other way to change that cost-benefit calculus is to make the present uncomfortable for the North Koreans. And that's really been, to me, the core of what the Trump administration's strategy is about.
And are you saying then that it's failing?
I don't think it is failing. You know, the president's tweets are completely unhelpful, so we should just put that off the table. But Secretary Tillerson, relying in part on people who are holdovers from the Obama administration, people like Susan Thornton and Joe Yun, have in fact, you know, articulated a strategy which is really just a variant of strategic patience, which is that the United States is willing to negotiate with North Korea. And Secretary Tillerson has even said that the United States doesn't have hostile intent. But in the interim, the Trump administration is aggressively using authorities that were actually first given to the president under the Obama administration to undertake secondary sanctions against Chinese and other firms that are doing business with North Korea. And so those sanctions are currently in the process of working, and we have some initial evidence that North Korea is starting to experience distress. The question is whether that distress will lead them to seek an off-ramp, for example, by trying to get relations with Beijing back on track, or whether they'll respond by another cycle of provocation.
Well, the problem, it seems to me, is timing. Yes, sanctions will certainly have a negative effect, but will they have an effect in time to deter North Korea from taking further steps which will make the situation even worse and potentially very dangerous? And that we don't know. Then related to that is the degree to which China will really enforce these sanctions, including the secondary sanctions that Seth just mentioned. So it seems to me that as a strategy, sanctions do make sense, but will they have an effect in time to avoid a further escalation of the crisis? That I have some doubts about.
And simultaneously, it seems that the U.S. is having military drills really near North Korea. What would the effects of that be, Stephen Haggard?
It really depends on exactly how those drills are conducted, you know, from cycle to cycle. There are two sets of exercises every year, one in the spring and one in the fall. But what the Trump administration has been doing is sending some particularly tough signals by doing things like having nuclear-capable bombers overfly the peninsula and, you know, sending signals that by moving aircraft carriers and other strategic assets that suggest not just deterrence, but the type of instruments that you could use for strike purposes, for long-run strike. So I think that if the exercises were conducted in a more low-key and more routine fashion, it would actually probably help the situation. But when these additional elements of signaling are added in, I think they can have a deleterious effect.
Well, then let's also add in the question of, if you had the ear of Donald Trump, Charles Armstrong, what would you say?
Well, I would say follow Teddy Roosevelt's advice, speak softly and carry a big stick, rather than what seems to be in some ways the opposite, which is to speak loudly and put yourself in the position of having your bluff called. So I think that certainly military deterrence is necessary. I think we have to be careful on the signals we send, lest they be interpreted by North Korea as more aggressive than we intend them to be. And this kind of miscalculation, I think, is the greatest threat to peace we have right now. Neither side wants war, but one could see the other's moves as an act that needs to be retaliated against in a short time. The second leg of this approach is economic sanctions, so keep steady on those, but don't expect China to solve the problem for us, because a third leg has to be offering a serious and detailed off-ramp that will give North Korea a way to get out of the situation through negotiation and ultimately denuclearization.
Do you see this as resolving in the long term, or do you see this as escalating?
Well, I think it depends on what you mean by the long term. I think we have to be truly patient and not have high expectations at the beginning. I don't think there will be an explosion. I certainly hope not. But I think the immediate issues need to be addressed before they get out of hand. And then we begin the long and difficult and complex process of a negotiated solution to the North Korean nuclear problem.
Stefan Haggard?
Well, one thing I think I've learned is that not all problems are amenable to solution, and that at least some thought has to be given to the possibility that we're going to be in a world which is similar to the one we've been in for some time looking forward. You know, we usually think of a crisis as a short, sharp event, but this nuclear crisis, in quotes, has been going on since 2002, 2003. So it's certainly possible that we could be in a world in which we have to think more in terms of deterrence and containment than actually solving the issue. But I would just emphasize something that Charles also has said, is there's a lot of attention given to the technology of sanctions and how to make them more effective. But I don't think the same effort has been given to figuring out what a set of negotiations would look like. The Chinese have a preliminary proposal on the table that they sketched out at the Putin-Xi summit earlier in the summer, but I don't think it has enough meat on it to be satisfactory to the United States. But on the other hand, the United States hasn't really put forward a more detailed approach to how it might talk to the North Koreans in either a bilateral or multilateral setting. So I think much more attention has to be given to what the talks might actually look like so that the North Koreans can respond to something concrete.
Well, Charles Armstrong and Stefan Haggard, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your research and your thoughts with us here on the program.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Stefan Haggard is professor of Korea-Pacific Studies and Political Science at the University of California, San Diego, and director of the Korea-Pacific Program. His latest book is Hard Target: Sanctions, Inducement in the Case of North Korea. Charles Armstrong is a professor of Korean Studies at Columbia University, and he is the author of The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, and The Koreas. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.